Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with tomorrow's primary race for the United States Senate in West Virginia, which has already emerged as an ugly feud between the disgraced coal baron Don Blankenship, who is responsible for the deaths of 29 miners, and Mitch McConnell, who Blankenship has attacked in racist TV ads as, quote, cocaine Mitch, and because of McConnell's marriage to Elaine Chao, accused him of having, quote, a China family, which has, quote, created millions of jobs for China people. Russell McIver, the editor of the Corporate Crime Reporter and author of On the Rampage, Corporate Predators and the Destruction of Democracy, who is currently working with the West Virginia local activist organization MorganCountyUSA.org, joins us. With the president, who won West Virginia by 40 points, likening a win by the recently jailed felon to Roy Moore's fate in Alabama, we'll discuss whether Trump's tweets today discouraging Republicans from voting for Blankenship will work, since Blankenship clearly won the recent debate on Fox against the other two leading candidates who came across as bickering politicians, while Blankenship presented himself as a regular guy. We will also speculate whether the Democrats are falling into the trap Hillary Clinton set for herself, hoping Trump would win the Republican presidential primary, given their assumption that Blankenship is the most beatable candidate for the Democratic incumbent, Senator Joe Manchin, to run against. Then, with Trump's new lawyer, Rudolph Giuliani, signaling to an Iranian opposition front group for the MEK, which was formally designated by the U.S. as a terrorist group, that the U.S. is about to pull out of the P5+1 deal with Iran, we will speak with Nada Hashemi, director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Denver. He joins us to discuss dire warnings coming from Iran's President Rouhani and, after the failures of the French and German leaders to talk sense into Trump, today's last-ditch effort by the UK Foreign Minister Boris Johnson, which appears to be equally futile since Trump will likely announce tomorrow that he will be tearing up the deal Obama made with Iran, China, Russia, France, the UK, and Germany. Then finally, we'll get an analysis of what is behind the rise in the price of oil, now up to $70 a barrel for the first time since 2014. Amy Myers Jaffe, the Senior Fellow for Energy and the Environment and Director of the Program on Energy Security and Climate Change at the Council on Foreign Relations, joins us to discuss how Russia and Saudi Arabia are cutting production to drive up prices, while the global growth in demand from China, India, and the U.S., where Detroit is making gas guzzlers again, has reached the point where the world will soon be consuming 100 million barrels of oil a day. And joining us now is Russell McIver, who is the editor of Corporate Crime Reporter. His books include Corporate Crime and Violence, Big Business Power and the Abuse of the Public Trust, Corporate Predators, The Hunt for Mega Profits and the Attack on Democracy, and On the Rampage, Corporate Predators and the Destruction of Democracy. He is currently working with the West Virginia local activist organization MorganCountyUSA.org. Welcome to Background Briefing, Russell McIver.
Thank you, Ian.
And Donald Trump won West Virginia by 30 points, but now he's intervening via tweet to try and discourage voters tomorrow in West Virginia, Republican voters in the primary. He said, to the great people of West Virginia, we have together a really great chance to keep making a big difference. Problem is, Don Blankenship, currently running for Senate, can't win the general election in your state. No way. Remember Alabama. Vote Representative Jenkins or A.G. Morrissey. Is that going to work, do you think, Russell?
Doesn't look like it. Blankenship, former CEO of Massey Energy, convicted of crimes related to the death of 29 miners at the Upper Big Branch mine in 2010, has millions of dollars and he's spending it freely. The other two candidates are as beholden to corporate interest and the corporate ideology as is Blankenship. That's Attorney General Patrick Morrissey, who's very close to the pharmaceutical industry. His wife's a lobbyist for Cardinal Health. He's conflicted out on one of the biggest issues in West Virginia, which is the opioid crisis. And Evan Jenkins, who is a former Democrat turned Republican, he was a corporate Democrat, now he's a corporate Republican. And the poll from 2 weeks ago showed Jenkins and Morrissey battling it out at about 24-25% each, and Blankenship trailing badly at 14%, three other candidates in single digits in the Republican primary, which is going to be held here tomorrow in West Virginia. But there was a huge undecided, about 40-50%. And then just a couple days ago, internal polling from Jenkins and Morrissey showed Blankenship in the lead, something like 31-28-27. And they all started attacking each other. Now, the reality is the thing turned on a Fox News debate, which was broadcast nationally last week, where Jenkins and Morrissey rightfully went after each other for being corporate stooges. And Blankenship just held back and made faces and said what he had to say, and he came off as the winner in that debate.
Because he wasn't a politician?
Because he pitched himself as an everyman outside the swamp where these two guys are from. The other thing that's happening, so Blankenship spending his millions, robocalling, mass mailing, we're being bombarded. Anybody that lives in West Virginia is being bombarded. And the Democrats are actually have a super PAC called Duty and Country. They're betting that Blankenship will be the easier candidate to beat in November. And so they're spending millions of dollars going after Evan Jenkins and Patrick Morrissey. So, for example, I mean, we just went to the box down at the end of our road and picked up this mailer from Duty and Country that says, West Virginians can't trust Evan Jenkins, doing favors for his political donors, profiting at your expense, engaging in secret payments and backroom deals. This is Duty and Country. This is the Democratic establishment meddling in the Republican primary in West Virginia. You know, we're talking about Schumer and the establishment Democrats. And it's the treasurer of this group is a guy named Booth Goodwin, who was the U.S. attorney who criminally prosecuted Blankenship. And so he's effectively criminally prosecuted Blankenship, put him in jail for a year. Blankenship gets out of jail, and now Booth Goodwin and the Democratic establishment is moving against his opponents to ensure that he wins the nomination on the theory that Manchin can beat him in November. But the reality is this is the same Democratic establishment that said that Hillary was going to win in a landslide. And so they're not recognizing the reality on the ground. And the reality on the ground is that Blankenship is coming off as a regular guy. He's connecting with West Virginia voters. And the other two come off as corporate lobbyist types mired in the swamp.
And again, I'm speaking with Russell McIver, who is the editor of Corporate Crime Reporter. His books include Corporate Crime and Violence, Big Business Power and the Abuse of the Public Trust, Corporate Predators, The Hunt for Mega Profits and the Attack on Democracy, and On the Rampage, Corporate Predators and the Destruction of Democracy. He is currently working with the West Virginia local activist organization, MorganCountyUSA.org. So just let's go back, though, to Attorney General Patrick Morrissey and his wife as a lobbyist for a pharmaceutical company. What's the opioid connection? Because my understanding is that West Virginia is the most impacted by the opioid epidemic, and there's one small town pharmacy that apparently received hundreds of thousands of doses of opioids. So there's something going on there, and I would think that if this woman isn't tied in with the pharmaceutical companies that making profits off all this misery that they're spreading, particularly in West Virginia, that would be a pretty strong campaign issue, wouldn't it?
Well, it is a strong campaign issue, and it's hurting Morrissey, and it might be the reason he loses this election among the many others that we're talking about. But the reality from anyone concerned about humanity in West Virginia and what's happening here is that these three candidates, of course, will do the corporation's bidding. And it's an internal Republican Party fight. And also, on the other hand, we have a corporate Democrat senator, Joe Manchin, who is embedded with the fossil fuel industry and the fracking industry here. So there's not much of a choice. The only choice citizens have in West Virginia tomorrow is Paula Jean Swearengin, who is a is running a grassroots campaign, primary campaign against Manchin in the Democratic primary. But there is hope in West Virginia, and it comes out of the coal field. So the Blankenship comes out of the coal fields in southern West Virginia, and southern West Virginia went Trump something like 80-20 in the last presidential election. But out of those same coal fields comes a former Army paratrooper by the name of Richard Ojeda. And Ojeda's story is instructive on how to turn the state around. He came back from Afghanistan and decided to run for political office, ran for state senate, the state legislature, and a couple weeks, and nobody gave him a chance, a couple weeks before his election for state senator in 2016, he was beaten with brass knuckles and sent into a coma. He was beaten into a coma. He thinks it was a political hit, almost died, comes out of the coma, and because of the publicity due to the attack, wins the state Senate seat. Now he is running for Congress. He's up in the Democratic primary for Congress in West Virginia 3 tomorrow. He's the hero of the teachers in the West Virginia teachers strike because he was the one state senator who early on stood up to defend them. He says things that he's sort of like a Huey Long in West Virginia. He says things like, when the pharmaceutical lobbyists come into my office in Charleston, I kick them out because they remind me of the Al-Qaeda thugs I faced in Afghanistan. And so he's got this anti-corporate populist bent. He's got a West Virginia profile Army paratrooper, and he's probably going to win the Democratic primary tomorrow against conventional mainstream corporate Democrats, and people are giving a very good chance of winning the congressional seat. Then his eyes are on the U.S. Senate. If he wins that, his eyes are on the U.S. Senate against Shelley Moore Capito in 2020, and he's leading the transformation, the grassroots transformation of West Virginia. And that, and he comes out of the same coal fields that Blankenship comes out of. The two things they have in common, this is instructive about change in the red states, is they don't speak corporate speak. They don't speak swamp speak or two-party corporate speak. They talk in narratives. So it's not a, it's not ideology. It's, hey, I was driving home and I almost got run off the road, so I pull into this Pizza Hut and there was this guy there who was the first responder, and I go over and I say, hey, you're eating alone, come join us, let's talk how to turn our state around. And we start talking about fundamental issues like, you know, he's running into a building where everybody's running out as a firefighter. These are the kinds of people we have to support. How can we get them some support from the state legislature? Maybe we have a severance tax on gas and fossil fuels. And so he talks in that kind of manner, in a way that people can understand. And so does Blankenship. But he comes from, they come from two different political perspectives. That's what they have in common. They can connect with the people of West Virginia. And so it's fascinating to watch this race this year, where Blankenship convicted in the deaths of 29 miners. If it was up to him, you know, he would have a Chinese top-down a political system. As he says, corporations are not a democracy. And then you have Ojeda, who comes from the exact opposite perspective, is we have to put the corporations in their place and put people first.
Well, of course, Trump also has that ability to talk. A lot of it is complete nonsense and it's quite fatuous, but at his rallies, he's engaging the people. And I think you're warning that the complacent Democrats thought Hillary had it wrapped up. And the same is now true in West Virginia, that the assumption is that Blankenship on the part of the Democrats is that they hope to run against Blankenship just as they hoped during the Republican presidential primaries in 2016 to run against Donald Trump.
But absolutely. And you see, the thing, Ian, about this is that if you report this straight up the way we're talking about it now, you get just as a couple weeks ago, I was talking to friends of mine in D.C., and they were laughing at me for predicting a Blankenship win. You write Corporate Crime Reporter, and I'm not supporting Blankenship. I'm telling you what's happening on the ground. And the same thing happened, you know, when 6 months out of the Trump-Hillary election, where it was all the signs on the ground in the Northeast were a Trump victory, but the swamp dwellers couldn't see it, in part because they were rooting for her so much, and it also in part because many of them were on the payroll. And so, yeah, so we have to learn from the reality on the ground. We cannot be blinded by the smoke and mirrors of the mainstream media and the Democratic and Republican establishments. We have to learn about what works on the ground. And the only way to do that is to go on the ground and talk to people and try and understand what's happening.
Well, let's play a little bit of the campaign commercials that Don Blankenship is playing, and they're getting national attention because they're so openly racist, and he's attacking Mitch McConnell, calling him Cocaine Mitch, because he's apparently a ship owned by Elaine Chao, Mitch McConnell's wife, the Secretary of Transportation. Her father owned the shipping line, and some cocaine was once found on it. Blankenship calls her father a wealthy China person and says Mitch McConnell has created millions of jobs for China people and that McConnell's China family has given him tens of millions of dollars. Let's play a clip of that, and then on the other side, talk about how a guy that is responsible for the death of 29 miners and a massive disastrous spill of toxic slurry back in 2000, which, by the way, Mitch McConnell got him off the hook for. Why would anybody vote for him? But let's just have the clip.
Hi, I'm Don Blankenship, candidate for U.S. Senate, and I approve this message.
Swamp Captain Mitch McConnell has created millions of jobs for China people. While doing so, Mitch has gotten rich. In fact, his China family has given him tens of millions of dollars. Mitch's swamp people are now running false negative ads against me. They are also childishly calling me despicable and mentally ill. The war to drain the swamp and create jobs for West Virginia people has begun. I will beat Joe Manchin and ditch Cocaine Mitch for the sake of the kids.
And let me get to the question then, Russell. Why would West Virginia voters vote for this guy with these strange ads? You say he did really well on the debates, but look at his record.
Well, not only that, but of course, you know, the New York Times reported, the irony of that, of course, is the New York Times reported recently that Blankenship has strong ties himself to China. And his fiance was born there. I think he considered at one time moving there. He likes their sort of dictatorial style of capitalism as part of his, you know, political philosophy. So clearly he's doing this, you know, his attacks on Obama, Obamacare, China are part of a political strategy to win the election. But the reality is that it's not about China here. It's about poor people seeking some kind of savior and some kind of person who's perceived to be not tied to the political establishment. So it's a very similar dynamic to what happened with Trump. And again, you go back to Ojeda, who's connecting with the same population without the appeal to nationalism or race, and with an appeal to helping people on the ground.
But to some people, and to some extent myself included, Russell, this feels a bit like the Stockholm Syndrome, identifying with your torturer. I mean, the state has been raped environmentally and in terms of its resources, coal, by these coal barons like Blankenship. And he's about the worst of them, isn't he? So that's what...
But Jim Justice, our governor, is a coal baron. He was a Democrat, then flipped to becoming a Republican. Blankenship, yes, responsible for the deaths of 29 miners. But let's say you're a Republican in West Virginia. Are you going to say that you would be better off? And I'm not arguing for Blankenship. I'm just saying from a person, West Virginia person, Republican's point of view, are you going to say you'd be better under Morris, Patrick Morrissey, I mean, that's the vote tomorrow. You have to choose between six candidates. And there are better and worse candidates, and I would never vote for any of them. But are you going to say you're going to be better with Patrick Morrissey or Evan Jenkins representing you in Washington than with Don Blankenship?
Well, I guess the answer is the people are right in that regard. So then at the end of the day, then...
At the end of the day, we have to build a political movement independent of the corporate two parties. And there, I mean, the Ojeda movement is within the Democratic Party. Some people want to do it that way. Some people want to do it outside. Whatever it is, a movement independent of the corporate structure that will stand up to the lobbyists in Charleston and in Washington. And that's the answer. It's not to say that Blankenship is better or worse than anybody else in the Republican Party. It's to say we can't have any of them. We can't have a corporate mansion Democrat. We have to build an independent political movement to challenge what I call the corporate crime lobby.
Yeah, but you got your model candidate there in the Army paratrooper, don't you?
Absolutely. And in fact, there's going to be a statewide meeting to plan what I can probably one of the most important meetings in West Virginia, where activists from around the state are going to come together to mobilize for the 2020 election, where there's a great candidate for governor. There'll be a great candidate for senator if Ojeda wins the congressional seat in WV3. And so there's a lot of activism going on fighting back. The feud within the Republican Party is going to have consequences for the U.S. Senate because the national parties are looking at this as a political fight that might determine control of the Senate. And Manchin and the establishment Republicans and Democrats have made a judgment that Blankenship's the guy they want to beat, and they have their best chance to beat Blankenship as opposed to the other two. But we're not as concerned with that as we are with building an alternative movement on the ground.
Well, Russell McCarver, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Russell McCarver, who's the editor of The Corporate Crime Reporter. His books include Corporate Crime and Violence, Big Business Power and the Abuse of the Public Trust, Corporate Predators, The Hunt for Mega Profits and the Attack on Democracy, and On the Rampage, Corporate Predators and the Destruction of Democracy. He's also currently working with the West Virginia local activist organization, MorganCountyUSA.org. We're going to take a brief station break and back discussing dire warnings coming from Iran's President Rouhani, with Trump poised to tear up the nuclear deal tomorrow.
I search the land below, looking for that love of mine left 20 long years ago. Her love I took in vain, her love I did not earn. Love is something that you might find.
So frustrating, I tell. Over and over and over again, my friend. You don't believe where I am by destruction.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Nada Hashmi, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future, and The Syria Dilemma. And his latest book is Sectarianization, Mapping the New Politics of the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nada Hashmi.
Thank you, Ian.
And on Saturday, before the MEC, the band previously banned or designated by the United States as a terrorist organization, the group MEK, Mujahideen al-Haq, they're pretty much a front group for the group that Rudy Giuliani spoke to on Saturday in Washington. They've been very generous with their money. They've bought off a lot of U.S. politicians, both on the Republican and Democratic side, some prominent people. So I imagine Rudy Giuliani got well paid for his presentation on Saturday.
He was rewarded handsomely, I think, by his affiliation, both in the past and the present, with this organization called the MEK, which your listeners should know is really a discredited Iranian cult with close ties to the regime of Saddam Hussein in Iraq, and now is effectively bankrolled by the Saudis and benefits from the political organizational network of right-wing pro-Israel supporters in the United States to be able to, you know, reach people like Rudolph Giuliani and John Bolton, the new national security advisor to Donald Trump.
Well, John Bolton's had long-standing ties to the MEK, has he not?
That's true. Actually, I would point out to your listeners just before you called me, Ian, that the New York Times has just put up a very, I think, informative and educational four-minute video explainer called MEK, the group that John Bolton wants to rule Iran. And I encourage people to look at it because it's a very nice summary of what this organization stands for. And they actually showed John Bolton at their one of their meetings openly calling for regime change. And, you know, next year we'll meet in Tehran. And so he's probably one of the most prominent American foreign policy individuals that has deep ties to this extremist cult. And the New York Times video does, I think, a pretty good job in explaining how deep the ties actually go.
Right, but isn't this Ahmad Chalabi all over again? Chalabi being this disgraced and discredited front man that the neocons in this country thought was going to be the Nelson Mandela of Iraq and that they were going to install him after they kicked Saddam out. And of course, he turned out to end up being an Iranian agent all along. But again, the stupidity and the narrow zealotry of the neocons seems to blind them to who these people are, or are they just simply corrupt? I mean, Giuliani's been getting, I think he got 20, 30,000 last time he spoke to Mick, so he's probably got more on Saturday.
It is very much like Ahmad Chalabi. In fact, I would say it's actually much worse than Ahmad Chalabi. Chalabi didn't have, you know, the same type of history of, you know, of killing people, of promoting a really extremist interpretation of Islam and, you know, doing the type of really crazy things that the MEK are known for. So I think it's actually much worse. And the second point that you mentioned, Ian, I think is, you know, connected to broader themes that are very much central to U.S. politics today, the deep corruption of our own political system that allows private interest groups to effectively buy political influence in Washington, D.C. And this, you know, touches many issues, not just U.S. foreign policy toward Iran. It touches questions of gun control and the NRA. It touches the question of the Israel-Palestine conflict and the, you know, influence that the AIPAC has on our elected officials. So, you know, those are some of the underlying themes that tie all of these issues together. And I think effectively, you know, you're right. People like Giuliani, people like, I think, John Bolton are fundamentally corrupt. I think there's a difference between Giuliani and actually Bolton. I think actually Bolton ideologically believes that the MEK represents some sort of democratic opposition. Rudolph Giuliani, you know, I think as most people realize now, is just simply a blatantly corrupt politician. You know, he was on the payroll of, you know, Recep Tayyip Erdogan not too long ago in Turkey, who is, you know, comes out of an Islamic sort of background, political background, and he was willing to do bidding. This is Rudolph Giuliani, was willing to do bidding for, you know, the president of Turkey if he could, if Giuliani could sort of help arrange via General Michael Flynn the kidnapping of the Turkish, you know, religious leader Fethullah Gulen, who lives in Pennsylvania. So Giuliani is just corrupt. I don't think he has any political principles, but I think John Bolton is a combination of not just being corrupt, but also deep ideological positions here that line him up with the MEK and their sort of very paranoid worldview with respect to internal Iranian politics.
And again, I'm speaking with Nada Hashemi, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future, and The Syria Dilemma. And his latest book is Sectarianization, Mapping the New Politics of the Middle East. Well, at this rally, or whatever you want to call it, on Saturday in Washington, Rudolph Giuliani said that regime change in Iran, quote, is the only way to achieve peace in the Middle East, and that President Trump, quote, is as committed to regime change as we are. And then he wanted to say, went on to say, with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo on his right side and National Security Advisor John Bolton on his left side, what do you think is going to happen to that agreement, referring to the JCPOA, the P5+1 agreement, which I think is all but inevitable that Trump's going to pull out of it on Saturday?
Well, actually, he announced today that 2 o'clock tomorrow is when he's going to make his announcement, Eastern Standard Time. So I think you're absolutely right. The deal is effectively dead. But I think the statement by Giuliani gives you an insight into what the Trump administration and the Trump administration's foreign policy advisors are actually thinking about U.S.-Iran policy. I think they very much have, you know, a regime change mandate in mind that they're hoping to, I think, move forward. And this will probably, you know, manifest itself in many different ways, probably funding and trying to support, you know, ethnic and religious groups in Iran that are upset with the status quo within Iran to try and foment destabilization on Iran's borders. It will probably result in more money for groups like the MEK. And fundamentally, it's really a disaster for the people of Iran. As I tweeted earlier this morning, the brutal irony of Giuliani's speech over the weekend is that it will have the exact opposite effect for the Iranian people. In other words, what Giuliani and Trump and Bolton are dreaming up right now will effectively embolden hardliners in Iran and undermine the work of genuine Iranian dissidents, reformists, and pro-democracy advocates in Iran. And so if you just actually speak to them, as I often do, they will tell you this, that this type of rhetoric from Giuliani, this embrace of the MEK, the tearing up of the Iran nuclear deal, is all a disaster for the possibilities of internal political change in Iran that is, I think, very widespread. And I think many people in Iran desperately want political change, but they want it on their own terms. They want it nonviolently, and they don't want it as a result of the statements of a very corrupt New York politician such as Rudolph Giuliani.
Well, we have examples of, for example, in Armenia, there's an extremely effective people's revolution going on that's joyful. Now, I'm not suggesting, as you've written the book about The People Reloaded, the Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future, how the young Iranians and the women in particular rose up and were shot in the streets by the Pasdaran, the militias associated with the Supreme Leader and the Quds forces and the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guard Corps. And, of course, you've seen thousands of young Iranians demonstrating against the government who want to impede their access to social media, just as the same has been happening in Russia, as a matter of fact. So those regimes in many ways are similar. But Rouhani's making these dire warnings to the United States. Is that to say that he sees the writing on the wall, that his fate is tied up as well? Because not that you can do anything to change Trump's mind. Already Merkel has tried, already Macron has tried, and today Boris Johnson is trying, the British foreign minister. They're getting nowhere. So let's just address what Rouhani is signaling here. What do you make of his dire warnings?
Yeah, I think he's officially sort of sending a message to the United States that this withdrawal from the nuclear agreement will have drastic consequences for the entire world, including the United States. What that actually means in terms of how Iran will respond to the nuclear deal, we don't know yet. But I think you're absolutely right, Ian, to point to the fact that Rouhani's, I think, political career is very much tied up to the future of the Iran nuclear agreement. And if Trump pulls out, then that effectively means that Rouhani's key foreign policy position and most popular sort of, you know, argument that he made that effectively got him elected was that, you know, he could restore Iran's economic viability. He could bring Iran out of isolation. The defeat of the Iran nuclear agreement effectively means that Hassan Rouhani is a lame duck president. His political career is absolutely over, and he knows it. And so I think that's why he's making these statements. Going back to what you said a moment ago in terms of the demonstrations in Armenia and the desire for political change in Iran in 2009 and the repression of the regime, there is deep discontent in Iran. There's a deep desire for political change. And sadly, what I'm seeing now is that the Trump administration, led by Giuliani and Bolton, using the rhetoric of regime change, are effectively going to try and hijack this very genuine domestic demand within Iran for political change by tainting it, by, in fact, giving an argument to Iranian hardliners to accuse every single opposition figure in Iran, every single human rights activist, tainting that person with being an agent of Giuliani, an agent of Trump, an agent of the United States. And the irony, I think, of what we're seeing right now with these statements from the Trump administration, the tearing up of the nuclear agreement, the embracing of this Iranian cult known as the MEK, is that all of these things are actually playing out in ways that strengthen the hardliners in Iran and undermine the the efforts of pro-democracy activists within Iran. They actually extend the shelf life of the Islamic Republic. And you just have to talk to them, and they'll tell you that the nuclear agreement was widely supported, overwhelmingly supported by Iranian civil society, because they felt that the creating conditions that prevented a war that increased the economic prospects for the Iranian middle class, which is the core of the pro-democracy movement, over the long period will actually help the efforts of Iranian dissidents and Iranian, you know, pro-democracy activists. So if you put this all together, Ian, it's actually a colossal disaster for the people of Iran, and it's ironically, you know, actually a blessing in disguise for Iranian hardliners who actually are happy to hear this rhetoric, happy to see the MEK play such a prominent role. And so all of this points to, I think, sure, a growing disaster that we're seeing unfolding, you know, before our eyes. And I think will start to take shape tomorrow afternoon when Trump makes his announcement on the Iran nuclear agreement. Everyone predicts he's going to tear it up, and that will effectively open the door, I think, to a very steady and gradual pathway towards some sort of military confrontation with Iran that will, I think, further destabilize the Middle East.
And, of course, the Iranian hardliners have sabotaged Rouhani's efforts to open up the country, which is what the young and the urban and educated and the women want in that country, because they keep arresting people. So there's a symbiosis between Trump and the hardliners. I wouldn't cross the street for Donald Trump. Do you think a young Iranian is going to take a bullet for this guy in the White House that most of the world despises and over half of this country is disgusted with? I mean, what an insanity. Anyway,
it's complete insanity. Totally agree with that, Ian, yeah.
Well, thanks a lot.
Thanks for the time, yeah.
And again, I've been speaking with Nada Hashemi, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future, and The Syria Dilemma. And his latest book is Sectarianization, Mapping the New Politics of the Middle East. We're going to take a brief station break and back with an analysis of what is behind the rise of oil, now up to $70 a barrel for the first time since 2014.
I've been waiting for years to buy a brand new Cadillac, but now that I've got one, gotta send it right back. I can't afford that gas from a brand new limousine.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Amy Myers Jaffe, the David M. Rubenstein Senior Fellow for Energy and the Environment and Director of the Program on Energy Security and Climate Change at the Council on Foreign Relations. She previously served as Executive Director for Energy and Sustainability at the University of California, Davis, and her books include Natural Gas and Geopolitics from 1970 to 2040. And Energy and Security Towards a New Foreign Policy Strategy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Amy Myers Jaffe.
Thank you very much.
So what's going on in terms of oil prices rising? Of course, here in California, gas has become quite expensive. U.S. oil prices have hit $70 a barrel for the first time since 2014. So what's causing this rise? And obviously, it's a fungible global product, so this is a global issue.
Definitely a global issue. We have a lot of geopolitical features influencing the price of oil today. First and foremost, we have OPEC, which has been working diligently to tighten the oil market back when oil prices were low and we were all enjoying lower gasoline prices. That was a strain for many OPEC countries because their revenues were greatly curtailed and they were having trouble funding their military expeditions and social programs. Same with the Russians. So we've had, for the last year or so, a very strong agreement between especially Saudi Arabia and Russia to take a little oil off the market to try to strengthen the market. But against that same backdrop, we've had several unexpected things. First of all, the production in Venezuela, like many other institutional and systems in Venezuela, is collapsing. The whole oil industry is collapsing inside out in Venezuela, so their oil production and exports are rapidly sinking. We have the conflict between Saudi Arabia and Yemen has been escalating, and the rebel factions from Yemen, the Houthi rebels that have backing from Iran, have not only used drone warfare against, unsuccessfully so far, against Saudi oil facilities, but they've announced that that is their intended target. And so that got the oil market a bit heated up. The president of Donald Trump tried tweeting, saying that OPEC was artificially raising prices and it was bad and they should do something else. And so far that hasn't helped. But the president has a decision tomorrow where he's going to announce whether or not he's reimposing oil sanctions on Iran. And it is estimated that if the European countries go along with a decision to nix the Iran nuclear deal and reimpose restrictions on purchases of oil from Iran, that European compliance with that policy and agreement with that policy would take another 500,000 barrels a day out of the oil market.
So you also, don't you have to add the fact that not only is production down in Venezuela, it's also down in Libya because the country is still in chaos, and in Nigeria because of, I think corruption also plays a part in Nigeria. So that's...
Well, I count Nigeria and Libya as a given because their production was down even when the price of oil was low.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yes, you have continuing problems there, and Angola is having some production problems. You know, there are other places that are oil-producing countries that have some problems. Even in Iraq, there have been, you know, conflict between the Kurdish region and the central government that's held some oil off the market. So, absolutely, there's no lack of geopolitical disruption to go around. And indeed, the good news of the story was that the global economy has been strong. China's growth has been faster than expected. Americans were back on the road and buying SUVs. So demand has also been stronger than expected. And that is really tightening the oil market quickly.
So given that demand is up, my understanding is that global demand is about to reach a record daily demand. I think it's 100 million barrels a day. Is that right?
Well, and that, of course, was this bellwether. You know, we used to think that 100 million barrels a day might be the level. I never thought that, but there were some who thought that that could be the most that oil could ever be produced. I think we're seeing, even here in the United States, you know, we have some pipeline bottlenecks and other things, but U.S. oil production now is about 10 million barrels a day, up from 5 from years ago. And we're kind of on our way to 15 million barrels a day in the next few years. So the U.S. will be one of the places that's going to be able to provide more oil. But, you know, there's also typically, as oil prices go up, governments step in and they do policies that are designed to eliminate oil demand permanently. And we're seeing that in China. China has a very strong policy to try to promote electric vehicles and energy efficiency. And over time, I think that will also play a role in correcting the market over time. But, you know, we have the problem where it's, you know, it's today, people are getting in their cars, and they will eventually adjust patterns of behavior. But until they do, you know, prices are rising.
But just to understand the math here, if a lot of big producers or relatively big producers like Venezuela, Nigeria, and Libya are pretty much off the market, and if Saudi Arabia is cutting back their output as well as Russia, and yet global demand is going up rapidly, then who's filling the breach? Is it the U.S.? And somebody else has to be filling the breach as well, right?
Well, the U.S., Canada, Brazil, I mean, the Americas are actually serving as the sort of savior in terms of market stability. We have a lot of prolific places in the Americas where private oil companies are expanding their activity and we're having more oil. And that had been enough to balance the market. Actually, it was creating an oversupply in the market. Even with Saudi and Russia cutting production, it had been enough. But this catastrophe that's happening both humanitarian and industry-wise in Venezuela is happening at a pace that was unexpectedly fast. So that's sort of thrown off the market. And honestly, I mean, speaking to you from California, the fact that Americans have gone back into SUVs and they're not choosing fuel-efficient vehicles is disappointing in terms of the fact that we have better vehicles available, and people are still buying, you know, bigger cars. And so because the U.S. economy is doing well and we have a lot of people back to work, which is a great thing, you have more people commuting. And if they're commuting not by public transportation but in large vehicles, you know, our demand's going up unexpectedly.
Well, how does this factor in with the possibility? When you were talking earlier about the end of the JCPOA, the P5 plus 1 deal with Iran, I think the signals are pretty clear that on May the 12th, which is pretty soon, the Trump administration will announce that they're pulling out of the deal. The British Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson is in Washington today. He's on Fox News earlier making his pitch, appealing to Donald Trump not to break the Iran deal. And prior to that, of course, Macron of France and Merkel of Germany did the same, but apparently to no avail. How is that going to affect things? Is there any indications that nervousness over what seems to be likely, has that already affected the market? And then once the hammer drops on May the 12th, what do you think is going to happen?
Well, I mean, again, you know, given the politics in the United States, one never likes to predict what the final policy is going to be coming out of the White House. But I think that the market is expecting the deal to be canceled. You know, there's a couple different options. You know, one option is there's a kick the can, which is to say we're going to negotiate for a month and see where things are because there's another deadline in July. But ultimately, you know, some of it's built into the market. Japan and some of the Europeans have already started to reduce their purchases from Iran, anticipating there might be a problem. And you're seeing more countries buying oil from Iraq, for example. So some of it's really in the market. And I think that some of the other factors that we discussed, the ongoing conflict between Saudi Arabia and Iran, the tension between them, combined with the fact that there's a proxy war that involves, you know, rebels who have missiles and drones in Yemen. That kind of backdrop in the market, in a tight market at the high demand gasoline season in the United States, that would inflate the market, even if we didn't have the Iranian backdrop. The combination of the problems in Venezuela, combined with the fears of conflict in the Middle East, and of course, if the White House drops the agreement with the Iranians, one would imagine a more conflictual attitude on all parties. And so I think the oil market would be afraid. You know, normally in a trading situation, you know, you buy the rumor and you sell the news is sort of the slogan that people say. So maybe if, you know, the shoe dropped tomorrow, you know, some people might be thinking that oil prices will drop. But frankly, I think over time, if people absorb the idea that the conflict with Iran is worsening, not getting better, and that there's an active proxy war that is targeting oil facilities inside Saudi Arabia, I think that that's a very explosive mix for oil prices. And so I would be surprised to see oil prices go down. Even if they go down briefly, I think we're on an upward path. And what's going to change the market is what changes the market every time we get to a situation like this. Either Saudi Arabia will sort of come to its senses and realize that back in 2006, 2007, they said the same kinds of things they said today about having an OPEC agreement, and they lost control of the market when it went to 147 and contributed to a giant global financial crisis and recession. That would be a bad outcome. Even if it doesn't turn out as badly as that and the price doesn't go up so as much, you know, in the United States, one of the research by a University of California San Diego professor, James Hamilton, shows that even as late as 2007 and 2008, when oil prices went up, Americans stopped buying durable goods, especially stopped buying automobiles. And because Ford just announced and other companies emphasized the sales of very large vehicles, and if the price of oil goes up a lot and we get to the summer and the price of gasoline is, well, in California it's probably over $3, but if we start getting to California towards $3.50 and $4, and other parts of the country we start getting between $3 and $3.50, then it will affect people's choices. People will stop buying big cars. That'll hurt the economy. People will not drive as much. People will not have as much disposable income. Deutsche Bank put out an analysis that said that they thought the entire benefit of the tax cuts to the middle class and lower income people would be completely wiped out by this fuel surge cost. So there could be some serious consequence to OPEC losing control of the market and having some other shoe drop, a new disruption that we don't know about coming on for, and having the market really get overheated.
Well, just in the last few minutes, let's talk about the possibility of another shoe dropping, because one of the consequences that most analysts of Iran suggest is that the U.S. pulling out of the JCPOA would definitely undercut President Rouhani, who sort of staked his reputation, if you will, on it. The reformer, for the want of a better description, the hardliners will be rejoicing. They'll be more, not that they've ever not been in control, but they'll be more in control, I guess, and more under siege as they lose customers. Israel is extremely nervous about Iran's activities and growing influence in Syria. So it's an explosive mix, and my understanding is that the Iranians have placed batteries of missiles in caves along the northern part of the Gulf aimed at Abqaiq and all of the Saudi terminals. So what would happen if this thing got out of control, if these speedboats in the Strait of Hormuz ran into an American ship, which Trump has already warned about, or something like that? It wouldn't take much to spark a conflagration, it would seem.
Yeah, so what I would say about that is, however alien in terms of their behavior, the Iranian government might see to an average American. This is a government that, while not treating its own population properly, it has shown restraint in terms of not going over a line that would cause an outright military conflict with the United States or Israel. And I think that they will still be careful not to, I mean, bombing Abqaiq, for example, which would be an astronomical problem, both just economically and for Saudi Arabia, like for a really long time. I that is such a giant act of war that the retaliation that would come from across the Middle East would be so huge. I just don't see the Iranian government taking a step like that. What I'm more concerned about is a rebel group takes a drone and flies it over some Saudi oil facility and maybe causes less damage. But then, is that or isn't that a retaliation? What is the scale of retaliation that comes from a more marginal attack on Saudi oil? Or what happens if these missiles that are coming from Yemen actually killed a lot of Saudi citizens? What would the Saudis need to do in response? And how does that affect what the United States does? So there is a lot of potential to move into a conflict situation that, as you described, could eventually be, a very negative outcome. But it might not be a giant act of war. I mean, it might be just these smaller incursions or annoyances that do escalate. And because we're setting a different tone, the ability to solve an escalation with diplomacy, gets harder and harder to do. I mean, there's no question that the United States would like to see the situation in Yemen be de-escalated. I don't see how we do that if we're not able to have a broader negotiation in the Middle East that involves the Iranians and even the Russians. And so sanctions policy is kind of tangled into that. And I'm sure there's some who argue that we have to put on more sanctions to prevent that conflict. But one could argue that once we do that, there's less incentive for diplomacy. I mean, you could read that on both sides. Once the shoe's dropped, what's my incentive to diplomacy? Before I drop the shoe, I might have an incentive to diplomacy to avoid the sanctions. So, I think we're in a pretty big bind in terms of trying to avoid an escalation of conflict, because right now we're in an escalation of conflict that, like you mentioned, is sort of hurtling toward, much more dangerous outcomes for everybody concerned.
Well, Amy Myers Jaffe, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Amy Myers Jaffe, who's the David M. Rubenstein Senior Fellow for Energy and the Environment and Director of the Program on Energy Security and Climate Change at the Council on Foreign Relations. She previously served as Executive Director for Energy and Sustainability at the University of California, Davis, and her books include Natural Gas and Geopolitics from 1970 to 2040 and Energy and Security Towards a New Foreign Policy Strategy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.